Your computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. We are speaking to Mr. Jim DiEugenio today from Los Angeles. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len.
Well, I haven't spoken to you for a little while, so I'm sure there's a lot of things to catch up on. What would you like to start with?
You know, I think it's been a month, hasn't it?
Well, I'll have to check, but it probably. Yeah, it's been more than 2 weeks. Usually you're on every second week, right?
Well, I guess it's time to get caught up, right?
Yeah.
Let me give you guys a preview of what's going to be going up probably tomorrow or the next day at Kennedy's and King, as well as a review, since I haven't been on in a while. I'm sure you're aware of this new documentary that's coming out about the Bobby Kennedy assassination. It's produced by the same people who did the movie I was working on, JFK Revisited, okay? That is, Oliver Stone is a main talking head, and Rob Wilson was the producer. Sean Stone was the director, and some of the other interview subjects are Lisa Pease, Bobby Kennedy Jr., and Dick Russell. It's called Legacy, okay? And I really hope you can get a couple of those people on your show to talk about the film. There's really been a lack of a documentary on the RFK case. I know Bobby Jr. has been trying to get one for the last couple of years, okay? And he finally did get one with Rob Wilson and Oliver Stone and Sean Stone. So if you go to Kennedy's and King, there's a link to how you can see the film as well as a trailer there. That's number one. Now, we're going to talk about this more later, but Russ Tarby sent me his review of Mrs. Payne's Garage. If you recall, that was a very bad book by Thomas Mallon, okay, which I believe was meant to distort and disguise the work of Carol Hewitt, Barbara LaMonica, and Steve Jones, the wonderful work they had done on Repaint, which we're going to talk about later. And so we reprinted and revised a little his review of Mrs. Payne's Garage. Ruth Payne passed away 2 or 3 weeks ago. All right, Michael Payne passed away many years ago. So that's why we went ahead and reran that. Now, the two most recent articles at Kennedy's and King are reprints of letters, okay? One by Oliver Stone and one by Douglas Horn. And in fact, the one by Douglas Horn is actually a combination of three letters. And these were all to Luna, Congresswoman Luna. All right, now, the one by Oliver is, if you can believe it, he calls me up one day and he says, Jim, did you know Marco Rubio is the acting archivist? I said, what? And he said, yeah, go take a look at the website. I said, I thought he was Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. He goes, Jim, go ahead, look, you'll see. And God darn, he was right. Marco Rubio was the acting archivist, okay, of the United States, which is really bizarre. You'd think having two big jobs like that would be enough. So Oliver was going to write this letter to Luna, but he switched up at the last minute and says, you know something? I'm going to go ahead and send it to Marco Rubio. And he tried to have it courier delivered so it would go right on his desk, but they couldn't do that. So he had it, you know, priority mail, you know, with his name on it to Marco Rubio. And so his letter, which you can read at Kenny's and King, is basically talks about the issues of the final determination notices that Andrew Eiler has been and Mark Adamczyk have been addressing so often and so recently. I'm pretty sure Andrew was on your show talking about it once, wasn't he?
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Okay. And so he's asking him about this, you know, about the final, are you aware of these things? And did you know that Clinton wrote a memo saying he would not override any of the final determinations? And are you aware that John Thunheim said he's never seen some of these documents? And he said that before the Luna committee, the second hearing. How could he have not have seen him in 4 years from 1994 to 1998? And then he says that according to the interested visitors at NARA, the state of the JFK records collection is simply and frankly a mess. There is no comprehensive, usable index or catalog, even though the JFK Act specifies that a function is to maintain one for each record. Now, his last point is that, look, even some of the HSCA records and even some of the church committee records are still being redacted. Now, this is really a sorry state of affairs, you know, because there has been no proper supervision of the board's decision since 1998, and there should have been, either by Congress or by the archivist or both. So he says, I'd like you to make a request to the Oversight Committee. There should be an explanation as to why these records are still closed and why the final determinations are not fully open. Now, I think what Oliver is really trying to say here is that whoever is running the JFK collection at the archives should be called before Congress to explain this. You know, why are we not getting the whole collection? And this is now, what, 63 years later? Okay. What is wrong exactly? You know, why can't the American public see this? And the archivist is responsible for this stuff. All right. Now, if the agency that is the ARB issued these final determination notices, number one, and if Trump issued that executive order, number two, then what is stopping the full disclosure? That's the question he's really asking. Right. So we printed that letter at Kennedy's and King. And then Andrew told me about these letters that Doug Horn, who you've also had on your show more than once, he was the military records analyst for the review board. And him and Jeremy Gunn did an inquiry into the autopsy evidence for that board. So he wrote three letters. Okay, one of them was about the final determination notices, about why these have not all been recovered by the National Archives. I mean, when Andrew and Paul Blow went down there, they could only find 450 of them. All right, but they're supposed to weave one for every one that was classified. And then second, there is the missing autopsy evidence. Okay, and he says that he lists 8 photographs, 2 JFK skull x-rays, and the fact that the skull x-rays appear to be copy films and not originals. He talks about the missing Harper fragment, the missing bullet fragments at Bethesda, all right, which were taken prior to the autopsy, all right, and this includes 1 vial with about 10 tiny fragments, 1 bullet fragment removed from Kennedy's back, okay, between his ribs, in four large bullet fragments, which Dennis David said that he recovered, right? And he sent another letter to Luna just to make sure he didn't miss his letter that he wrote to Jake Schellnhuber, who was supposed to be running that committee. Excuse me, Jake Greenberg, that's his name, right? Who's not easy to talk to, right? So that's an update. And you'll only find this stuff, of course, at Kennedy's and King, right? So please take a look at that. I think it's very important, all right? And it's really terrific. You know, Oliver Stone doesn't have to do this. The guy's a multimillionaire. He has about three different houses throughout the United States. He's 78 years old. He could just sit at home and be waited on by his wife and his maid. But instead, he's out there doing this stuff, which is, and nobody in Hollywood is doing this kind of stuff that he's doing. So we should all be thankful, you know, for that. All right. Now, let's take a look at some letters. All right. August the 20th, Bill Coles, this is from Bill Coles. He's one of the best people that we have on our side. He reads Kennedy's and King. He emails me every once in a while. And I want to talk about something that he sent me when I get done with this question. All right. I've always wondered about Hemi. What was the connection, his connection to the JFK assassination? And was he ever interviewed by the House Select Committee? I heard a very poor interview of him, meaning the sound quality. And it sounded like he was a gun for hire. Any thoughts? I think Hemi was interviewed by the House Select Committee. And some of those interviews, I agree, do not have the best sound quality, all right? But I think he was. And he was also interviewed by several different writers, you know, Mark Lane and Anthony Summers, et cetera. I've always had a problem with Hemi. I think he's passed away now, in that he backed up that what I believe to be the unbelievable Marita Lorenz story that is in plausible denial about the procession of the parade, the motorcade, into Dallas that included people like Howard Hunt, et cetera. All right. That's always been my problem with Jerry Hemi, because I simply don't buy that story. Right? I think Hemi said a lot of things to a lot of different people. Right? I think he's one of these guys who tried to be all things to everybody. Did he have a connection to the JFK case? I don't know. I'm not sure. It's something that you can't be certain about because he had such, and let's be frank about it, he had such a big mouth, you know. Now, let me add something that Bill Coles sent. Bill Coles sent me these newspapers from back when the JFK case was just breaking. You can believe it. They're from the period of November 23rd to November the 25th. I don't know how the heck he got these things. But they were in pretty good condition, right? And it's really something to see. The first one, this is actually Friday, November the 22nd. Headline, President slain, the Minneapolis Star, sniper cuts down Kennedy, Texas governor in Dallas. So in other words, the first story was that they were both of them that were gone, which is, of course, did not turn out to be true. Now, that's from November 22nd. Now, there's another one.
Okay. These are newspapers you got, right?
Yes. And like I said, I have no idea where the heck he got these things, you know? But like I said, they were in pretty good condition, all right? Okay, now, here's another one, November the 23rd. Was Connally the main target? And then there's a picture of Oswald, okay, and they say he's raising his clenched fist, which he wasn't, of course. All right, it was a very crowded hallway, and he was trying to get comfortable. And then Johnson picks up the nation's reins. That's the headline. Affairs of state put ahead of grief. In other words, let's forget about Kennedy already. Monday appointed a day of mourning. They're already looking forward to the funeral. And there's a story about from Nikita Khrushchev from Moscow, death is a blow to peace lovers. Well, you weren't kidding about that, were you, Nikita? Now, there's also a last photo section in the Minneapolis Star the last pictures taken of JFK in Dallas. But the one I want to concentrate on, which I think is historically important, and I'm going to explain why I think that, is the one from, what's the date on this? November 25th. Because I cannot impress upon people enough the way that the media swallowed every stupid story that was put out by the authorities. On page 2A, fingerprints reported to be on rifle. Do you believe that? Fingerprints reported to be on rifle. We know that that wasn't true because Sebastian Latona had the rifle that night. He did everything the FBI got. Couldn't find any prints on the rifle. No fingerprints of use. Or was it you could use in a court of law? But that story gets out there. Then it says map for slaying found in Oswald's room. You believe that? What that was he was mapping out places to go for a job in the Texas Employment Commission. And how about this one? Mexico visit reported. See, this is how a brilliant black op works. Okay? You know, Mexico visit reported. All right? The Mexican newspaper said on September 26, Oswald met with Cuban counsel Eusebio Askew and demanded a visa for travel to Soviet Russia via Cuba. When the counsel suggested a need to process such a request, Excelsior said Oswald left in a temper and slammed the door behind him. Now, what's missing from that story? Askew said it wasn't Oswald. Okay? So in other words, this cover story is being put out almost immediately. This is this Mexico City, which is, you know, one of the keys of the plot. This is out there within 72 hours, okay? Which is really kind of amazing. And, you know, Oswald's already dead because he was killed that Sunday, all right? So here we are, you know, on Monday, and they're going ahead and closing the coffin with this visit to Mexico City, which never really happened. So that's one of the things I wanted to go over because I think it's really important to understand how these things work and how the disinformation gets out there. So thanks for that, Bill. All right, August 29th, Andrew Schlick. Are the pictures you see of the shot into the windshield frame and then the shot in the windshield real? You know, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I don't consider myself an expert on photography. Now, whether or not there was a shot through the windshield, I'm not sure. There were witnesses who said that there was such a shot through the windshield. I think one lady said she actually put a pencil through the hole. I think there were something like five witnesses who said this was so. And David Lifton always used to say that they switched windshields. Dave Mantic says that also. But like I said, I'm not positive about that. So my opinion is not probative. There's no doubt that it's a very, very interesting story. All right. And then who was that guy who was the expert on this that you had on your show who passed away?
Doug Weldon?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Doug Weldon. Okay. If you want to look up his essays online, I mean, he did the most work, I believe, of anybody on that subject. Okay. All right. September the 3rd, Thomas Kaska, a longtime and avid listener. With the last of JFK records released and the passing of Ruth Payne, you are coming to the end of the Living History Witnesses. I was wondering, do you have thoughts on whether or not Marina Oswald has anything left to say, or perhaps her daughters after Marina passes away? Ruth Payne also had children. Any thoughts? Thanks, and thank you for all the very hard work that you do to continue to keep this subject alive. Well, I don't think Marina really has anything else to say about this. I believe one of her children works for the CIA. I'm not sure about that, but that's something that I heard. Now, Ruth Payne had two children, a girl and a boy. I'm not sure about them either. I mean, it would be interesting as heck to talk to one of them. You know, but I don't know how fruitful that would be. But that's a good lead-in for my Substack series, which has been attracting some attention, as I'm sure you're aware, on my Substack, which you can find by looking at James Anthony DeGenio. You will see that I've been hard at work, a very busy beaver, on what the legacy of Ruth Payne is. And so what I did is I essentially did four parts, and I started with what I considered a backgrounder. And what this did is it went ahead and laid in what Michael and Ruth were about, where they came from. All right. And it also tried to spell in the case that what role she played and about her testimony, because nobody testified longer than Ruth Payne did to the Warren Commission. She was there for 6 days, 5 in March and 1 in July. She was asked over 5,000 questions. All right. Nobody even came close to that. Now, probably no one, except maybe Marina, who we know did a transformation on this, because at the beginning, she insisted that Oswald's rifle was not the one in the picture. And secondly, that Oswald didn't go to Mexico City once she was threatened with deportation. That changed. All right. Now, Ruth Payne didn't do any flip. Ruth Payne, from the very beginning, thought that Oswald was guilty and there weren't any questions about it.
Well, that's what she said, but I think when they revealed the FBI had tapped the phone call between her husband, like that day, they said, we both know who did it.
Now, I think she said the exact word was, we both know who's responsible.
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
I was going to get to that in the last part of my installment. But in this, I just wanted to talk about a lot of her background, which I believe Ruth and Michael have some very, very interesting people who they were a part of. Okay, let's begin with Michael. Michael comes from, there's no other way to say that. He comes from the founding families of America. I'm talking about the Forbes family and the Cabots. I mean, these kind of people looked down on the Kennedys because the Kennedys were novo rich. They weren't. They went all the way back to the 13 colonies. So, and by the way, actually before that. So this is where they come from on the one side. Now, I'm sure you're also aware that Alan Dulles, one of his girlfriends, was Mary Bancroft, who was best friends with Ruth Forbes, the mother of Michael Payne. Okay, and he used to joke about how the JFK researchers would have a field day if they knew that. Now, what else is very interesting about this is that let's take a look at what happens to Oswald when he returns from Russia with his wife, Marina Oswald. Well, Georgia Morenchild comes tapping on his door, the white Russian, the oil geologist, and he suddenly becomes Oswald's buddy. Now, this is bizarre right in and of itself. Why would a white Russian want to be friendly with a communist? Okay. So then, de Morenchild has a gathering of white Russians plus Ruth Payne at his house. I believe that's in February of 1963. And this is where Ruth meets Marina, all right? And in no time flat, Ruth begins to put a full court press on Marina Oswald, all right? First, she writes her a note, then she visits her, and then she invites the Oswalds for dinner at her home, even though the couple was separated. Michael was there that night. Then, and remember, this is in April. This is like less than 2 months after they were introduced. Ruth wrote a note to Marina, which she insisted she never sent, but it was an invitation that Marina come to live with her. Man, this is 6 weeks, okay? Now, that obviously would separate Marina from Lee. Why would you want to do that? All right. Then there was a shared picnic. And then by the end of April, Marina's temporarily staying with Ruth because Lee is in New Orleans looking for an apartment. All right. So then when he does find one, Marina goes to New Orleans and Ruth begins a summertime correspondence with Marina. And during that correspondence, she again brings up the idea of Marina moving in with her. Now, anybody who knows anything about the Paines understands that Ruth went on a long journey that summer, visiting friends and relatives, all right? Then the last visit, I believe, was to her sister, all right, in, I believe, Falls Church, Virginia. At least that's where they said they lived. There's differing information on that, all right, that they actually lived in Maryland at the time. So Ruth then swings around to the south and picks up Marina. Now, what's odd about this is that it's not as impromptu as it seems, because according to the interviews the FBI did, Ruth told more than one person that she was going to pick up Marina in New Orleans and bring her home to live with her. In other words, what I'm saying is, by the end of the summer, okay, beginning of the fall, Ruth Paine had apparently accomplished what she wanted to do, which was to separate Marina from Lee. The excuse being that she wanted Marina to deliver her child, and she thought it would be more convenient if she did it at her home. All right? Now, of course, this was oh so convenient for the official story due to the fact that Ruth became the most questioned witness before the Warren Commission. And also, as we're going to see, her garage became a literal treasure trove of evidence against Oswald. The problem, as I see it, is that what the sheriff's office and what the Dallas PD could not find in 2 days of searches, miraculously, Ruth began to bring forth all this stuff that they had missed several days later.
Yeah, when we did an episode on 50 Reasons about it, the title was The Paine's Garage, The Gift That Keeps on Giving.
Exactly right. Now, we talked a little bit about the background of Ruth and Michael Paine. Georgia Morenfeld's brother, Dimitri, was a pen pal of Ellen Dulles back in the early 1950s. He was involved with one of the CIA's pet projects, Radio Free Europe. He was also the co-editor with Bill Chamberlain of a journal called Russian Review. Well, Chamberlain was also friends with Ellen Dulles. And in fact, Chamberlain advised him while he was on the Warren Commission. And one of the things he advised him about was how to steer clear of exposing the intelligence ties of George and Dimitri to Morenfeld. Right? Now, Ellen Dulles referred an attorney named Herbert Itkin in 1954 who wanted to get into the petroleum business on how to meet with George de Morenfeld. What makes that fascinating is that Dulles knew de Morenfeld well enough to understand that at that time he used an alias. The alias was Philip Urban, right? And this, of course, is because de Morenfeld had a cozy relationship with the CIA. And in fact, before he passed away, he told writer Edward Epstein that, look, I would have never met Oswald in 100 years unless I'd been advised to do so by the CIA station chief, J. Walton Moore. And in fact, it turned out that J. Walton Moore and Georgia Morenchild were kind of buddies. The Morenchild had him at his house to eat dinner a few times. Okay? Now, to some people, it appears to be that the Morenchild agreed to do this favor for J. Walton Moore in return for an assignment in Haiti to CIA with trying to overthrow the Duvalier regime. And according to reports, the Morenchild got a $300,000 deposit in his bank account, which of course would be about $2.5 million today. Now, let's talk a little bit about another connection, that is Frederick Osborne. When the FBI went ahead and interviewed Osborne in December of 1963, actually his son, Frederick Osborne Jr., out of the blue, they attested to the Paines, quote, religiosity, good character, and innocence, and having anything to do with the assassination of President Kennedy. Well, here's my question. In December of 1963, who was accusing the Paines of being in on the JFK case? And it turned out that Osborne's father was a friend of Alan Dulles from Princeton. Now, Ruth's family was from New York before moving to Ohio. Her father was an executive for the Nationwide Insurance Company. He did work for the OSS in World War II. He ended up being a regional director for the Agency for International Development, which, as we know, was a cover company for the CIA. Right? Now, Dulles was actually in Dallas about 3 weeks before the Kennedy assassination. And he was selling his book, The Craft of Intelligence, which was ghostwritten by Howard Hunt. And as Mark Lane clearly suggests in his book, Plausible Denial, Hunt very likely was in Dallas on the day of the assassination. Now, when Garrison called Ruth Paine to testify before his grand jury in New Orleans, he wanted to know who her sister worked for because he couldn't get an answer to that question. It was being withheld from him. So he asked her, and she said she wasn't sure. She didn't know. Well, it turns out that her sister, Sylvia Hyde Hope, had been employed by the CIA for a number of years as a psychologist. It's hard to believe that Ruth did not know this. And, I mean, she stayed with her before she picked up Marina. Didn't Sylvia tell her where she was going every day when she left for work? All right. And by the way, if that is also revealed in the phone directory, okay, that she worked with. So it's very hard to believe that she did not know this, okay? So the question then becomes, why was she so fearful about revealing it to Jim Garrison? Okay. That's a very interesting question, I believe. All right. Now, in part two, we'll do one and two tonight and can do the rest on another night. I talk about some of the evidence which makes Ruth and Michael kind of suspicious. The first one is the mystery of the Minix camera, all right? What am I talking about? When the Dallas police searched the Paine household, they found a Minix camera, and reportedly, Gus Rose found it in Oswald's sea bag the weekend of the assassination. That story got into the local papers. In other words, the question is, what is this guy who's working at a Texas school book depository for a minimum wage? What is he doing in possession of a very rare and expensive camera? which you have to send away to a certain place to get the film developed. Why would a manual laborer have that kind of exotic camera? This mystery got into the local papers. The FBI now had a problem. They had to somehow do a disappearing act on the Minix camera. They literally erased it from the Dallas police inventory list. Literally, like it never existed. All right. And when the Dallas police sent a picture inventory to the FBI, the picture of the Minix also disappeared. All right. It was categorized as item number 375 on the joint inventory list. All right. And so when it was returned to Dallas police by the FBI, it had turned into a light meter. I mean, isn't that something? And by the way, John Armstrong sent me, I don't know how the heck he got this picture, but he sent me a picture of this photographic stuff on the floor of the Dallas police, in which the FBI had fogged the background of the picture so you wouldn't see the Minix camera, all right? So they returned it as a Minix light meter. Now, Gordon Shanklin, who was the local FBI chief, was informed by the FBI in Washington about this discrepancy. They told Shanklin that they had no Minix camera. So now Shanklin goes around with the cover story that no such camera had been found, only a light meter, which of course contradicted the Dallas police, right? So now J. Edgar Hoover stepped into this growing controversy, and he said that Shanklin should inquire about this mystery with the Dallas police, Marina Oswald, and the last person on the list is Ruth Payne. So Bardwell Odom, one of the local FBI agents, now contacted Ruth Payne to see if the Paynes owned the Minix camera. All right. Ruth said that her husband, Michael, had owned one, but had discarded it a long time ago. Then she backtracked and said, she called Odom the next day and said, wait a minute, Michael still had the camera. All right. So in other words, we're supposed to believe that the Dallas police missed a second Minix camera, all right? And since Michael's camera is going to go ahead and replace the Oswald camera, we're supposed to believe that they originally fabricated the Minix camera that they originally found. Now, if you don't believe those things, which I don't believe myself, okay, I don't believe they could miss that, number one, and I believe they did find a Minix camera on the first visit, then you have to then come to the conclusion that the Paynes are in collusion with the FBI to do a cover-up of who Oswald really was, which the Minix camera would have indicated who he really was. Now, how eager were they willing to go along with this BS story? He said, Michael Payne said, that when the cops arrived, he gave them a drawer full of photographic equipment with everything except his Minix. He then said that he told them the Minix was in the garage, but they weren't interested. All right. Now, you could not be more cooperative with the FBI than Michael Payne was, because now he said that the light meter that was taken that weekend was his. I mean, talk about going along with this little play.
Yeah, because it was never a light meter.
That Hoover was drawing for Gordon Shanklin and Bardwell Odom. So now the Paynes had solved the FBI's problem. Now they could now match the original inventory list of the DPD, as long as you didn't look too closely at the dates that objects appeared and disappeared in the chain of evidence. Okay, and then who got them there? In Bardwell Odom's January 31st, 1964 report, he wrote that the police, quote, were aware that no such minute camera was taken in the original search, unquote. That is really one of the most, that is one of the biggest whoppers that the FBI told, and they told a bunch of them. As Carol Hewitt once wrote, the fact that this is false was exposed by the fact the FBI was examining a Minix camera on November the 25th, 1963. Well, whose camera was that then? It wasn't Michael's. Now, also, the Paynes were close to Bob Odom. That's why they didn't call him Bardwell. They called him Bob. And Michael said that he'd been introduced to Bardwell Odom prior to the assassination. Okay? Now, I believe that any objective person would have to say that the Paynes were doing everything they could to get the FBI out of a difficult situation. And by the way, let me say, this went on for three decades, because on that horrible PBS Frontline farce, Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald, in 1993, Sullivan re-ran this charade that it was really Mike Paine and it was his Minix camera. So they did it again. They did it once back in 1963, 1964, and Mike Paine did it again in 1993. I mean, this is how willing they were to sacrifice Oswald. All right, now, Ruth, in one of her last public appearances in Dallas, at the Dupre Theater in November of 2023, she was being questioned by, of all people, Thomas Mallon, and he screened the questions. Johnny Cairns was there, okay? And he wrote an article about this. Ruth Paine's big, which he considers her ace in the hole, is that somehow Oswald took a shot at General Walker, and that proved that Oswald shot Kennedy. I've never understood this logic, because Walker was a right-wing nut who was actually canned by Kennedy. Okay? And Kennedy had to stand in federal marshals to Ole Miss to break up a riot that Walker had arranged to stop the integration of that college. All right? How does that reconcile with shooting at the most liberal president since Franklin Roosevelt? Now, also, the other big problem is that the best witness of the crime, Kirk Coleman, said that there was more than one person involved in the Walker shooting. I mean, who could that be if it was Oswald? All right? And third, as John Armstrong has proven, the projectile recovered from the Walker scene does not match Oswald's rifle, either in caliber or in color, okay? If I remember correctly, it was a 30-06 that the Dallas police recovered. And it wasn't copper-coated. It was more like a lead color, all right? So Ruth Paine's ace in the hole is not really an ace. It's more like a deuce, all right? Now, here is why I believe that Ruth does this. 1 week after the Kennedy assassination, Ruth found evidence that somehow the Dallas police missed. She turned over two books to the Irving police and said that they had to get this to Marina. She couldn't do without these books. All right. Well, inside one of the books, the Book of Helpful Instruction, was an undated and unsigned, written in Russian note. Okay. And it generally advises Marina on what to do in case an emergency arose and Oswald was held in detention. Originally, Marina said she didn't know anything about this note. And Ruth said, well, she was unaware of it also. Just happened to be in Marina's book, and Marina didn't see it. For how long? The Walker shooting, I believe, is in April. Okay? This is like November the 30th, and somehow Marina never saw this. All right? Now, some of the things that Ruth left out when she talked about this note was, number one, the note does not mention Walker. Secondly, when the FBI analyzed the note, none of the seven latent prints matched either Lee or Marina. How could you write a note like that and not leave your prints on it? The House Select Committee Document Experts Panel could not decide on the authenticity of the note or if it was written by Oswald. Okay? Finally, Ruth said that before she left the house on the day of the assassination, she saw officers leafing through books to see if anything fell out. Well, how could they miss this? All right. Now, Ruth understood that she had a big problem with this last statement. So in 2023, in this appearance at Johnny Caron's shop, Ruth said the book was in the kitchen, and so that might have been the problem. Well, the problem is for Ruth that Johnny put together a diagram of the house. The garage is right off the kitchen. So all they had to do was take one step up and they'd be in the kitchen. All right? Now, here's what I believe to be the capper about this whole Walker note malarkey. The Secret Service was so suspicious about that piece of evidence that two of them visited Ruth on December the 4th with a note in their hand. Why? Because they thought it was from her. Okay? Now, Ruth and Marina had been fast friends since April, which I've already talked about. All right, but this relationship cooled down after the assassination. When Marina Oswald testified before Jim Garrison's grand jury, she was asked about this matter. She was asked, do you still associate with Ruth Payne? Marina said no. Well, the question is, why not? Marina answered with the following. She said the relationship was dissolved at the request of the Secret Service because they said it would not look good if the public found out that she, Ruth, had friends over there, and it would be bad for me if people find out a connection between me, Ruth, and CIA. The assistant DA then asked her, in other words, you were left with the distinct impression that she, Ruth, was in some way connected with the CIA. And Marina replied to that in the affirmative. I love that phrase, that Ruth had friends over there, which means the Secret Service was all over Ruth Payne, you know, with the returning of the note and then telling Marina that you shouldn't be associating with her because she has friends over there at the agency. All right. Now, let me close out this initial discussion with another matter referring to the cameras Oswald allegedly had. Right. When the Dallas police searched the Ruth Payne home, the Ruth and Michael Payne home. Like we said, one of the cameras found was a Minix that was made to disappear. But there were two others that were found. An American-made stereo realist and a Russian-made Quora 2. Both those two cameras used 35mm film. And the Minix used a specially made cartridge film. The problem was this. The police did not find an Imperial reflex camera of the type that took the infamous backyard photos of Oswald. That camera took 620 roll film. In 2 days of searching, this camera did not show up. Initially, to the FBI, Marina said she recognized the Quera and the stereo realist. Then, when she got to the Warren Commission, that changed. She said she didn't recognize the stereo realist anymore. On December the 8th, 1963, 2 weeks after the search of her home. Let me say that again. 2 weeks after the search of her home, Ruth Payne discovered the Imperial reflex camera. That discovery was so shocking that the FBI called in the Dallas police officers that originally searched their house. 4 out of 5 said they never saw that camera there. Right? The one dissenting guy said he saw it, but he didn't think it was important. Yeah, sure. Now, when Ruth discovered the Imperial reflex on December the 8th, she didn't turn it over to the FBI or to the police. She gave it to Robert Oswald. On February the 9th, after conferring with Robert, Marina and her two children moved into Robert's home in Denton, Texas, which is about, I think, 50 miles south of Dallas. Yet he had not shown the camera to her. All right? Even though we had it for a while. Okay. All right. On February the 24th, Robert Oswald gave the Imperial reflex camera to, drum roll please, Bardwell Odom, the friend of Michael Payne. So the question becomes, why did Ruth not do that 2 months earlier? All right. But in order to complete this new second camera charade, Marina now disowned the stereo realist camera. And now she recognized the Imperial reflex. Then, 2 months after she testified to that, in August of 1964, the stereo realist was returned to Ruth Payne. Let me say that again. In August of 1964, the stereo realist was returned to Ruth Payne. No questions were asked about why Ruth or Michael never claimed that that was their camera in 8 months. Or why Ruth had kept so quiet about the Imperial reflex. You know, whatever was needed, if you needed a substitute Minix, if you needed a Walker note, if you needed the Imperial reflex, all allegedly missed by the DPD, they were found by Ruth and Michael Payne. Okay? Like Cyril Buck said about the single bullet theory, whatever you need, that bullet will do it for you. Okay? Well, whatever the Warren Commission needed, Ruth and Michael Payne supplied it to them. Okay, so that's 1 and 2. like I said, the last part, the last installment, part five, will be going up very soon, like within a few days. And I want to tell everyone that I just completed what I think is one of the best articles that I've ever written for Kennedy's and King. It's in two parts. It's called Clay Shaw in Italy, Amid Permandex and Gladio. And this is, I believe, a kind of 3D in-depth look at what Shaw was doing in the midst of all of these secret programs, secret societies, and this included Permandex, it included Propaganda Due, which I'm sure you're aware of, P2, all right? This included Gladio, the secret stay-behind armies of NATO, and included the strategy of tension, all right, which I'm sure you're aware of. If you're not, the strategy of tension was a deliberate bombing program and assassinations set up by the Gladio forces in order to blame it on the left, when in fact the right wing had performed them in order to keep the Christian Democrats in power, which is who had been funded by the CIA almost from the beginning, about like 1948, 1949. I really think this is one of the best things I've ever written. So we'll also talk about that in addition to finishing up the pains.
All right, yeah. Okay. Very good. All right, I guess as we wrap up, well, I'll talk to you probably in a week or 2 weeks for sure then.
Okay, then.
Thank you very much for your time tonight then, Jim. I know people write into it, they say they appreciate it. Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.